needs. Well, let me take a step back. I think Carvel's definition of Afrofuturism is correct but incomplete in the following way, and I don't mean this critically to Carvel in any way, but Afrofuturism, which is an area that I study some and have written on, is not only about how blacks from the future, but it's also a way of allegorizing how we think about current modes of oppression, marginalization. So you take a graphic novel like Concrete Park or Nela Hopkinson's Brown Girl in the Ring, and it's trying to retell stories of incarceration. And so part of what I thought Black Panther could be up to, and I think a lot of people thought it was up to, was recontextualizing the story of oppression. But let me give you one very basic example about how this all breaks down. We have children being taken to go see this movie. Most American Black children, the only American Black characters in the movie are, you know, are the subjects of violence and rejection. And at the very end, in this neoliberal moment, a spaceship comes out of the sky, or a flying machine comes out of the sky that was invisible. Kids go up to it, and one of the final lines in the movie has a kid saying, "Can we break it apart and sell it?" And I want to ask the Ryan Coogler question. If a kid in those kind of circumstances sees a flying machine, they don't want to break it apart. They want to get in it and fly. They want to go someplace. So it's this reproduction that American brown-skinned people, brown-skinned kids, cannot seem to get out of the structures that obviously oppress them.
We're
they
gonna
seem
have to
reproduce.
We're going to have to leave it there because the show ends now, but we're going to do part two and post it online, so do stay with us. We've been talking to Carvel Wallace, who wrote the New York Times piece, as well as Robin Spencer and Christopher LeBron. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining.
This is KBOO Portland. It is a little past 5, and coming up next, we have KBOO Evening News.
The Sea.
KBOO hosts a monthly film series called KBOO at the Clinton. This month, we'll screen the film Seed, The Untold Story, on Thursday, March 8th at 7 p.m. In the last century, 94 seed varieties have disappeared. 10 agrochemical companies control over two-thirds of the global seed market, reaping unprecedented profits. Seed, The Untold Story, is a documentary film following seed keepers and farmers who are defending the future of food. After the film, there will be a Q&A with film director Taggart Siegel and folks from the Pollinator Collective and Cultivate Oregon. Again, that's a film screening of the documentary Seed, The Untold Story, Thursday, March 8th at 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with the requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available by calling the station at 503-231-8032. Meetings will be held at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland. The Engineering Committee will meet on the first Wednesday at 7 p.m.
It's now easier than ever for somebody to make and distribute music, but it's much harder to be noticed. It's difficult for me to find the independent artists that I'm interested in through all of the choices. And it's a big part of the responsibility of KBOO and other independent cultural institutions to bring attention to new local artists and musicians and help break through that clutter. KBOO understands the importance of expression, and we need your help to make a city of media makers where we can all express ourselves artistically and freely. This is the power of KBOO. Invest in future media makers and join us on Kickstarter today. Go to kboo.fm/Kickstarter, and thank you for your support of KBOO.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, Village of Hope and Portland Tenants United stage a dramatic action at today's City Council meeting.
Senate Bill 1512, which would add Oregon to the list of states awarding Electoral College votes only to presidential candidates who win the national popular vote, appears to have died in the Oregon legislature.
The most recent Pentagon budget came in at over $700 billion.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Wednesday, February 28th, 2018. I'm Brian Pritchett.
And I'm Erin J. Bernard. KBOO News poet Dan Raphael views the past and present of guns in the U.S.
The United States of Ammunition was founded on the principle of using guns to take land and make people slaves. We had a revolution because the British said the Ohio River was a national growth boundary, and George Washington and his fellow slave-owning land developers wouldn't stand for that. As the world runs out of trees, metals, food, the only surplus is people, warehoused into ghettos and shipping containers, kept in their places by men with guns. Undocumented workers are slaves their bosses don't have to house or feed. The Supreme Court ruled yesterday that immigrants, even those with green cards, have no rights to a speedy trial and can spend years in for-profit detention. Soon that court will rule to cripple labor unions so long stagnant wages can go even lower. Instead of the Pledge of Allegiance, our days will start with the Miranda rights. I have the right to remain silent. Anything I say or do will be used against me. For Poetic Justice, this is Dan Raphael.
The group that's been trying to build support for a soda tax in Multnomah County told Willamette Week today that it will not seek a place on this November's ballot after all. The Coalition for Healthy Kids and Education has decided it will not file a measure for the November 2018 election, said campaign manager Terry Steenbergen in a statement. While there will be no ballot measure in the current political cycle, our diverse and broad coalition of parents, educators, health professionals, over 100 organizations and small businesses remains committed to working toward reducing soda consumption, strong programs, and healthy outcomes for our kids, she said. The tax the group is contemplating would have added 1.5 cents to the cost of each ounce of soda. The idea of a soda tax is not new in Multnomah County. Local activists first contemplated such a tax in 2010. They hoped to fight obesity and related diseases and to put some money towards public health. Since then, other cities, including Berkeley in 2014, Philadelphia, Oakland, and San Francisco in 2016, and Seattle in 2017, have passed their own soda taxes, but the local efforts here have stalled. Last year, John Arnold, a billionaire former energy trader, and Michael Bloomberg, the billionaire and former New York mayor, put more than $900,000 into an education and signature gathering effort aimed at the May 2018 ballot. They needed 17,381 valid signatures, which, despite strong opposition from the soda industry, is not a heavy lift. But in November, the Coalition for Healthy Kids and Education announced it would defer its ballot battle with the soda industry until November 2018, and perhaps even farther into the future. Today, they picked the latter option.
Senate Bill 1512, which would add Oregon to the list of states awarding electoral college votes only to presidential candidates who win the national popular vote, appears to have died in the Oregon legislature. In the wake of Donald Trump losing the popular vote by over 3 million, yet still winning the Electoral College and the presidency, the bill seemed sure to pass when first introduced. The central obstacle to the bill is Senate President Peter Courtney, who said he'll only let his chamber pass the bill if the question is then referred to voters. However, John Koza, the wealthy entrepreneur who founded and funds the organization pushing the issue, only wants the legislators to decide, not the voters. The national popular vote change will only take effect when states with a total of 270 electoral votes, a majority, have joined in. Currently, 10 states, including California and Washington, with 165 votes are in the compact. In other election news, Oregon Secretary of State Dennis Richardson yesterday asked the legislature for $166,000 to hire a staffer to combat election hacking activities by the Russian government.
Joe Gibson wants to go to Washington. The leader of the right-wing group Patriot Prayer announced his plans to run for the U.S. Senate during an event on Sunday night in Vancouver, his hometown. The move makes Gibson, 34, the first declared Republican candidate looking to unseat Senator Maria Cantwell of Washington, a popular three-term incumbent with a whopping war chest. "It's going to take a miracle to happen for me to win," Gibson told roughly 100 supporters at the historic Red Cross building at Fort Vancouver, a national park site near downtown. But miracles happen in America every day. The crowd gave several standing ovations and erupted into chants of USA as the newly minted candidate railed against a rigged and broken political system and raised the promise of a conservative revolution in the Pacific Northwest. A former high school football coach who now flips houses for a living, Gibson earned a growing profile in the past year for his willingness to lead right-leaning marches and rallies in liberal West Coast enclaves. His demonstrations have been criticized for attracting white nationalists and others who promote racist or bigoted views, though Gibson has publicly denounced such individuals and their beliefs. Gibson's appearances in Portland, billed as free speech events, have at times drawn hundreds of counter-protesters to downtown. They've triggered violent clashes between his supporters, many of them die-hard Donald Trump fans, and anti-fascist activists, also known as Antifa. On his campaign website, Gibson has swapped his signature black hoodie and backward baseball cap for a blazer and a button-down shirt. In an interview with the Oregonian's Oregon Live, he said he wants his libertarian and populist-tinged Senate bid to target big business and career politicians and will support term limits for elected officials and advocate for eliminating tax loopholes for corporations. Gibson took aim at Monsanto, the agricultural behemoth, for its poor environmental record, and pharmaceutical giants like Pfizer for driving up healthcare costs. When it comes to immigration, Gibson, a devout Christian, said he supports a path to legal status for undocumented workers who have no criminal record. He is also a proponent of gay marriage and marijuana decriminalization. Should Gibson clinch the Republican nomination, he would still have an uphill battle against Cantwell. The Democratic incumbent has $4 million in the bank, campaign finance figures show. In 2012, she coasted to re-election with more than 60% of the vote.
Today, the Port of Vancouver voted to terminate the lease of a company that has been trying to build an oil terminal on the site for 5 years. The Tesoro Savage proposal garnered support from Labor and some in the local government, but was opposed by a wide-ranging coalition of community, environmental, and political actors. Last year, ahead of a hearing on the proposed terminal at the Washington State Energy Facility Site Evaluation Council, or EFSEC, KABU spoke with Dan Sears, conservation director at Columbia Riverkeeper. He explained the reasoning behind the strong opposition.
The Tesoro Savage project would bring over 360,000 barrels of oil each day through the Vancouver area. That's up to five loaded 100-car oil trains coming each day through the Columbia River Gorge, and millions of gallons of crude oil being stored along the banks of the Columbia River.
Washington Governor Jay Inslee denied Tesoro Savage's proposal on January 29th after years of community demands that he do so. The port was scheduled to terminate the lease a month from now, and the early termination appears to have been a mutual decision between the port and Tesoro Savage. Addressing the port's Board of Commissioners this morning, the general manager of Tesoro Savage said the company would donate its last month's rent to local community organizations.
An Oregon school district's policy for protecting transgender rights is on the line. Kyle Qureshi has more in this Oregon News Service report.
A lawsuit is challenging an Oregon school district's policy protecting transgender students, but opponents say the case should be thrown out. The ACLU of Oregon wants to intervene on behalf of Basic Rights Oregon, the state's largest LGBTQ advocacy group, in the case of the Dallas School District located near Salem. A group known as Parents for Privacy sued the district in November over its policy allowing students to use bathrooms and facilities that conform to their gender identity. Amy Hertzfeld-Koppel is a co-executive director of Basic Rights Oregon.
We feel like it's fundamentally mean-spirited and transphobic and motivated by a desire to exclude trans students from school life and not respect their dignity.
Parents for Privacy says the school district is violating the rights of other students by accommodating transgender students. Similar cases against school districts in Illinois and Pennsylvania have failed in recent years. The ACLU still is waiting to hear if it can intervene or if the case will be dismissed. The Dallas School District also has filed a motion to dismiss the case. Oregon Department of Education guidance issued by Governor Kate Brown outlines how school districts should accommodate transgender students. Hertzfeld-Koppel says Basic Rights Oregon provided input in developing these guidelines.
We worked with the Oregon Department of Education in 2016 to release new guidelines that are trans-inclusive and are among some of the strongest guidelines in the country to make sure that K-12 schools are providing a safe and inclusive learning environment for trans students.
Oregon has strengthened protections even as the federal government has weakened them. Last year, the U.S. Department of Education rescinded guidance that outlined federal protections for transgender students. From KABU Community Radio and Oregon News Service, I'm Kyle Qureshi.
Members of the Village of Hope community got one step closer to having their demands heard by City Hall today. KABU reporter Jasmine Moneymaker was at this morning's City Council session and filed this report.
Commissioners, Mayor, we told you that we would be back. You must leave the Village of Hope. We're not going to stay here for the testimony. After several failed attempts to open a dialogue with City Commissioner Amanda Fritz, residents and leaders from the Village of Hope took their frustrations to City Hall today. As the AM session of City Council opened, residents and supporters were in council chambers holding signs that read, "We are the Village of Hope. We need space and keep hope alive." Before Mayor Ted Wheeler could make his usual speech about expectations for conduct and the potential for arrest, the villagers said their piece, walked out of council chambers, and across the hall to Commissioner Fritz's office. Fritz is the City Parks Commissioner and, in the eyes of villagers, the person most responsible for instructing park rangers and police to forcibly evict the people who had begun building the Village of Hope on Airport Way. The village was swept on February 2nd, and since then, village representatives have been attempting to speak with Fritz directly. After multiple emails and calls were met with silence, they adopted a new strategy. They would occupy her office until she agreed to meet with them.
Who here has been wanting to speak to Amanda Fritz?
All of us.
And what is it that you've been wanting to say?
Give us a place.
Just give us a little piece. Don't ask. We don't need their help.
Has she agreed to speak to you?
No.
What's been her reason?
We haven't even talked to her.
She hasn't responded.
She hasn't responded.
Three people. Four emails.
How many times have you reached out?
Four times.
No response.
None.
No response over social media.
Right.
Got no response from any of my.
And we've been real. We've been honest, and we've been patient. And our patience is running out. We need a place to be.
Village spokesperson Steve Kimes and managers Robert Carey and Thumper, along with a few other supporters, sat on the reception area floor, chanting loud enough to be heard in council chambers.
No evictions. How many people have to die? How many people have to freeze? How many people have to die? How many people have to freeze? How many people have to die? How many people have to freeze? How many people have to die?
Within 10 minutes of the villagers entering Fritz's office, village spokesperson Steve Kimes informed the group that a meeting had been scheduled for the following Tuesday. The brief occupation ended with a cheer, and they are now focused on making their case to Fritz for the right to reestablish the Village of Hope, ideally at its previous location on Airport Way.
That's where we're kind of like comfortable, yeah. I mean, it's for the group of people that kind of set it up. That's, if you will, that's more or less our home turf. We've been camping in and around that area for quite a while. We were just a little chunk of, there's close to 150 people out there in a 20 square block radius.
Thumper, a resident and manager of the village, said communities like the Village of Hope provide crucial safety, stability, and dignity.
It's a place that people can be where they've got an address or where they can set up appointments, make the appointments, mental health, social security, whatever. Because if you're on the streets and you get swept, all those appointments you got to start all over from the beginning, and you can't make any forward progress. It brings a little bit of their self-esteem back. You know, it's all about giving people that chance to start to make that change, to get off the streets if that's what they want to do.
The city's approach to people who are unsheltered is to push them into sanctioned city shelters. But according to Thumper, even if there were enough room in city shelters for everyone, shelters just don't work for everyone.
They want us to all come downtown to the shelters. I don't feel safe in shelter, and I don't know too many people that do. Okay, not only that, but the shelters can't handle all of us. There are thousands, I don't know, they've never really done a census in several years, but just a conservative estimate, I'm going to guess it's probably close to 4,000 homeless people just in Portland area, if not more.
Yeah. He also said that though the Airport Way location isn't perfect, it is where he and the other villagers feel most comfortable, and they would like the city to allow them to return and establish a safe, accountable community.
We're not asking anything from the city, just a piece of land. It's industrial land that they have not yet developed. Okay, it's right next to a place that does semiconductors, they've got hazardous chemicals there. But and we weren't heard. There's been people camping in that spot for 30 years. I've been camping here off and on for 10 years. So it's not like it was nothing new. It was not like we were harming anybody. We weren't in a neighborhood where people could say, oh, we don't want it in our neighborhood. We had a little bit of resistance from some of the businesses because they have had problems in the past. But anytime they have a problem, they automatically blame it on homeless. And 9 out of 10 times, it's not from us.
Robert Carey, Thumper, and Steve will meet with Commissioner Fritz next Tuesday afternoon. As Thumper put it, they rarely do what we want them to do. We've got to celebrate when they do. As of airtime tonight, a call to Commissioner Fritz's office requesting comment on today's action and the demands of the Village of Hope residents had not been returned. Jasmine Moneymaker, KBOO News.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for news from the BOO. At 6 o'clock, it's The Underground, and then at 7, it's Hard Knock Radio, news and views from a hip-hop perspective. Tonight's weather should be a 100% chance of rain, with wind gusts as high as 25 miles an hour and a low of 38 degrees. Today in history, in 1968, Soul on Ice, Black Panther leader Eldridge Cleaver's prison memoir, was published. Our quote of the day is from economist and columnist Paul Krugman, who's 65 today, and said, "The problem isn't that people don't understand how good things are, it's that they know, from personal experience, that things really aren't that good."
The Supreme Court on Monday declined to enter the national controversy over the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals Program, or DACA, turning down the Trump administration's request to immediately review lower court decisions that keep in place the program that protects undocumented immigrants brought here as children from deportation. President Donald Trump announced in September that he would let the program expire in March unless Congress acted. Efforts on Capitol Hill to revive DACA as part of a broader deal on immigration policy have failed. Federal district judges in California and New York have issued nationwide injunctions against ending the program, siding with states and organizations challenging the administration's recession. The court orders effectively blocked the Trump administration from ending the program on March 5th as planned. No appellate court has reviewed those decisions, and it would have been exceedingly rare for the Supreme Court to take up a case without that interim step. In the past, the court has granted such cases only in matters of grave national importance, such as the controversy over President Richard Nixon's White House tapes or solving the Iranian hostage crisis.
House Intelligence Committee Democrats on Saturday published their counter to the Nunes memo, a controversial document compiled under Representative Devin Nunes of California, the committee chair. The Nunes memo alleges the FBI acquired FISA court permission to spy on Trump campaign aide Carter Page using the Steele dossier, which was created with funding from a Clinton campaign lawyer not telling the court the information's source. The new memo defends the FBI, claiming the agency was conducting its own probe of the Trump campaign for 7 weeks before obtaining the Steele dossier. That dossier was only narrowly used in the surveillance application, the counter memo says, with proper identification of its political provenance. President Trump condemned the counter memo while claiming it proves surveillance abuses against his campaign. The Democrats on the House Intelligence Committee released their redacted memo on Saturday, which rebuts many claims made in a GOP memo released earlier this month. The GOP memo accused FBI and Justice Department officials of abusing a surveillance program to improperly spy on the Trump campaign. The memo said an unverified dossier compiled by Christopher Steele and funded in part by Democrats was used to gain permission through a Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court to spy on Page, a Trump campaign advisor. Democrats, basing their memo on the same classified material the GOP memo used, say their newly released information provides important context. Himes, who serves on the House Intelligence Committee, on Sunday disputed a specific point in the GOP memo that claims former FBI Deputy Director Andrew McCabe testified to the committee that the FBI would not have sought the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act application against Page without the Steele dossier. Andrew McCabe did not say the FISA warrant would not have been sought, said Hines, who was also present for the closed-door testimony in question. He claimed that McCabe said the dossier was important for the application. Reaction to the Democrats' memo fell along partisan lines. Democrats praised the new document for debunking claims laid out in the GOP memo. Republicans and the White House said the new document does not refute anything in the GOP memo, and President Trump ripped the Democratic release as a political and legal bust. Himes, on Sunday, rejected Republican claims that the Department of Justice was biased towards the Trump campaign, noting former FBI Director James Comey made multiple public statements about the Bureau's investigation into Democratic candidate Hillary Clinton, at least some of which Clinton says hurt her chances in the election. The memo also notes that judges that granted the FISA application were Republican appointees. If there was any bias within the FBI and DOJ, they had a very weird way of showing it during the campaign itself, Himes said.
As students at Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School in Florida return to class, the ongoing consequences of the shooting remain unclear. The federal government has taken no action for gun reform, and Trump has backed off on banning bump stocks and raising the age for gun purchases, right in line with the NRA's unwavering stance. But yesterday, Dick's Sporting Goods, a large national chain, announced they would immediately stop selling assault-style weapons, high-capacity magazines, and bump stocks. They now also require all gun purchasers to be 21 or older. Dick's CEO Ed Stack revealed that Nicholas Cruz, the Parkland shooter, had purchased a shotgun, not used in the shootings, at a Dick's store in the past 4 months. In the wake of the shooting, several companies have stopped giving discounts to NRA members, while others, such as FedEx, still do. Walmart, the nation's largest gun seller, stopped selling AR-15s and other semi-automatic weapons in 2015 because of weak sales.
Jared Kushner, President Trump's son-in-law and close advisor, lost his interim top security clearance, but will he lose his White House job? Many wonder how, without such clearance, Kushner can continue working on his wide-ranging portfolio that includes issues like Middle East negotiations and U.S. relations with China. U.S. intelligence officials have said that officials in at least four countries have privately discussed ways they can manipulate Jared Kushner by taking advantage of his complex business arrangements, financial difficulties, and lack of foreign policy experience. Kushner is already under scrutiny for possible involvement in alleged Russian election hacking. Despite Kushner's lack of highest clearance, Trump still has the option of sharing any and all information with him directly. Although on the job for a year, Kushner's security clearance had remained interim, in part because he had omitted dozens of financial holdings and two meetings with Russian officials on his initial application for clearance.
And now it's time for today's report from National Native News, the daily newscast dedicated to Native American news, issues, and culture.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Montana's governor declared a state of emergency Tuesday for three reservations after a series of storms. Nikki Ouellette of Montana Public Radio reports.
The emergency declaration covers the Blackfeet, Fort Belknap, and Northern Cheyenne reservations. It frees up equipment and funds and extends hours for fuel delivery. The declaration is retroactive to February 14th. Robert DeRozier, incident commander for the Blackfeet Nation, says the reservation has seen more than two straight weeks of blizzard weather.
We've been ordering up some more extra resources. We've got loaders and graders and snow blowers, snow plows coming from every direction. So we've been very thankful for that. The snow amounts are just phenomenal. This is going to be a winter we talk about for quite some time.
The Blackfeet Nation declared its own state of emergency January 4th. Parts of the reservation have received 50 more inches of snow than normal, and strong winds have blown snow into 20-foot drifts. Roads have closed intermittently, stranding residents in outlier communities. Food and firewood are in short supply, even with a massive donation effort from other parts of the state. Reverend Calvin Hill of the Blackfeet United Methodist Parish in Browning says a handful of stranded travelers have been staying at the church, which opened an emergency shelter with the American Red Cross last week.
We also are doing daily feeds, breakfast if people need it, dinner if people need it, and luncheon if people need it. And then with the first responders, we've got that meal box that we send out with the first responders. And as much firewood as the first responders can take with them, they take that also.
Schools have struggled to keep their doors open. Hart Butte School has been closed for 12 of the past 14 school days. For National Native News, I'm Nikki Ouellette. A Montana university has resolved a discrimination complaint filed last year by a Native American student group. Montana Public Radio's Edward O'Brien has more.
Montana State University Northern and the Sweetgrass Society student group signed on to the agreement, which settles the complaint alleging racial discrimination and First Amendment violations at the school. Senior Amy Murdoch is the Sweetgrass Society's president.
We got everything we asked for. Our main thing of what we wanted was to move forward in a positive change so that other Native American students and other minority students could come to Northern and not feel discrimination.
The complaint filed last year with the Montana Human Rights Bureau involved an outdoor staircase where campus student clubs paint various messages. In 2016, the Sweetgrass Society painted hashtag no dapple on the stairs to protest construction of the controversial Dakota Access Pipeline. MSU Northern determined the hashtag was vandalism and painted over the club steps. The American Civil Liberties Union of Montana took up the students' case. MSU Northern's Director of Indian Education, Margaret Campbell, describes the mediation process between the two sides as
one of the more emotional processes I've ever been involved in. But at the end of the day, what came out of that is that the chancellor and the Sweetgrass students have a much better relationship, a much healthier reciprocal relationship.
The agreement announced this week requires the North Central Montana University to implement campus-wide diversity education and implicit bias training. For National Native News, I'm Edward O'Brien.
The U.S. Supreme Court Tuesday decided in favor of the Gun Lake Tribe in a land and trust dispute. A claimant challenged the Interior Department's authority to acquire land and trust for the Michigan Tribe. The years-long issue went to the Interior Department, Supreme Court, Congress, and back to the Supreme Court. The case affirms the tribe's right to its homelands and reinforces Congress's authority to pass laws to acquire land and trust for tribes. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
And now here's Labor History in 2 with Rick Smith.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. On this day in labor history, the year was 1942. That was the day that Sue Cowan Williams filed a lawsuit for equal pay for black teachers in Little Rock, Arkansas. 86 black teachers worked in the city's segregated school system. They were all members of the Little Rock Classroom Teachers Association. In 1941, the teachers formed a salary adjustment committee to look into pay discrimination. What they found there was a wide gap between black and white salaries. The average white elementary school teacher made $526 a year, while the black teacher earned only $321. White high school teachers brought home $856 a year, while black teachers only made $567. Backed with this research, the committee presented a petition to the school board demanding an end to pay discrimination. The board tabled the petition, and that summer passed another round of unequal pay raises. The teachers then approached the NAACP and asked them to handle their case. Thurgood Marshall agreed to take up the lawsuit. Marshall would go on to become the first black U.S. Supreme Court justice. Sue Cowan Williams, the head of the English department at Dunbar High School, was selected as the plaintiff for the case. The teachers lost their lawsuit and then won on appeal, but Williams paid a price for her involvement. The next school year, the school district did not renew her contract. She was finally rehired to teach at Dunbar a decade later. But first, the school superintendent called Williams to ask her if she had, quote, learned her lesson. It was a lesson that many workers have learned, that there is often a high personal cost for standing up for justice on the job. Like what you hear? Check out more at laborhistoryin2.com.
The most recent Pentagon budget came in at over $700 billion, and estimates are that there are at least 800 U.S. military bases around the world and probably more. But even retired military officers question the need for so many bases. Ann Garrison of Pacifica has this report.
Late last year, a divided Congress unified to pass a military spending bill of $700 billion, more than either the President or the Pentagon had requested. Hundreds of billions are devoted to U.S. military bases spanning the globe. These are voices from the No Foreign Bases Conference at the University of Baltimore, January 12 to 14. First, Leah Bulger, retired U.S. military commander, full-time peace activist, and current president of Veterans for Peace.
This conference is the first action, the first event that a relatively new coalition, which is a coalition against U.S. foreign military bases, has come together with several charter organizations, 13 charter organizations, and we are joined in order to address the issue of U.S. foreign bases, which are everywhere, somewhere between 800 and 1,000 in 172 countries. Ridiculous.
Here's David Swanson, co-founder of World Beyond War and author of the books War is a Lie and War is Never Just.
You know, I watch a lot of basketball games because the University of Virginia is so darn good, and I'm just disgusted because every single game they thank the troops for watching from 175, sometimes they say more than 175 or 177 countries. They thank the almost a million, you know, men and women serving our country. What the service is, they don't explain why they have to be in 177 countries. The fact that there are only about 200 countries on Earth, that there's at least a dozen more countries they're not telling us. You know, these are the ones they admit to. What are they doing there? What are they needed for? And in some cases, it's thousands. In some cases, it's tens of thousands, 50,000 troops still in Germany, still winning World War II, you know, three quarters of a century later. It's insanity. And of course, it costs hundreds of billions of dollars for people who think that we're running low on money and we can't afford things. We could afford anything we wanted if we didn't do things this stupid.
And here's Ajamu Baraka, Black Agenda Report editor, founder of the National Black Alliance for Peace, and 2016 Green Party vice presidential candidate.
So my friends, we have a task before us this weekend. We have to struggle among ourselves to build a baseline for unity, because we know that all of us may not be there in terms of being prepared to take a clear class line. We may not have full agreement on what it means for national oppression and national liberation. We may not be in agreement in terms of the character of this state, but we can agree that anytime you have this state involved in direct intervention, anytime you have this state that is involved in attacking another state and another people and another nation, that is a crime that all of us can be united in opposing.
That was Leah Bulger, David Swanson, and Ajamu Baraka at the No Foreign Bases Conference at the University of Baltimore, January 12th to 14th. All three serve on the board of the new Coalition Against U.S. Foreign Military Bases, NoForeignBases.org. In Berkeley, for Pacifica, I'm Ann Garrett.
Now it's time for a daily climate change report from Climate Connections.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizowitz, and this is Climate Connections. In the U.S. last year, 16 weather-related disasters, including hurricanes, wildfires, and floods, each caused at least $1 billion in damage. NOAA, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, has been tracking the cost of weather-related events for nearly 40 years. In that time, no year has seen more billion-dollar disasters than 2017, even after adjusting for inflation. But it was not an outlier. On average, these events are getting more frequent. 8 of the 9 years with the greatest number of billion-dollar disasters have occurred within the past decade.
Climate change is playing a role in increasing the frequency and intensity of some types of these extreme weather events and climate events that lead to billion-dollar disasters.
That's NOAA climatologist Adam Smith. He says that droughts, wildfires, and inland floods are expected to get more severe. And with sea level rise and more extreme storms, coastal areas are increasingly vulnerable. So he says cities and states need to prepare now, because billion-dollar disasters are likely to become even more common in the future.
Our vulnerability has increased, and the costs continue to rise.
Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. Learn more at yaleclimateconnections.org.
A federal appeals court decided that Arctic ring seals should be protected under the Endangered Species Act. For more, here's H2O Radio.
On Monday, February 12th, a federal appeals court decided that Arctic ringed seals should be protected under the Endangered Species Act. The decision comes as the sea ice where the seals make their homes has been hitting record low levels. The National Marine Fisheries Service listed the seals as threatened by climate change, even though there are currently about 1.5 million of them. Using the best available science, the agency determined that the seals face extinction in the foreseeable future because their habitat is disappearing due to climate change. Kristen Monsell of the Center for Biological Diversity told H2O Radio that the seals' habitat would become unrecognizable because of sea ice loss and also due to lack of snow cover.
Arctic ring seals are very unique in that their pups aren't born with blubber. So what the seals do is they build these snow caves on top of the sea ice to give birth in and then nurse their pups until they're weaned. And without the snow caves, without the ability to build these snow caves, the pups can freeze to death or are eaten by polar bears and other predators.
Both the state of Alaska and the oil and gas industry had fought listing the seals as threatened. Now, however, the federal government must designate areas that are critical for the seals, and that could affect fossil fuel development that the industry wants to pursue in the Arctic. Monsell stated that if we are going to protect the seals' habitat, it's even more important to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. She said that the proposals by the current administration are doing just the opposite, opening the Arctic to more drilling, which would be like releasing a carbon bomb. Alaska and oil companies have the ability to appeal the decision, which Monsell says has very little likelihood of success. For H2O Radio, I'm Jamie Sudler.
Writers and organizers, including Ajamu Baraka and Maurice Carney, are warning of a U.S. attempt to topple the governments of Venezuela. KPFA Radio's Ann Garrison reports.
Ajamu Baraka is a Black Agenda Report editor, the Green Party's 2016 vice presidential candidate, and a founder of Black Alliance for Peace. On this week's Black Agenda Radio, he warned of a U.S. invasion or proxy invasion of Venezuela.
We are very concerned about very troubling signs regarding Venezuela. It appears that the rhetoric of regime change that we hear coming from the current administration might in fact reflect a real strategy. We have heard that there are military units from the Colombian state and even the state of Brazil up on the borders of Venezuela. We know that the talks that were taking place between the government and the so-called opposition broke down because the opposition at the very last moment decided that they were not going to sign the agreement that everybody thought had been brokered and was in place. So it appears that the U.S. state has opted for some type of intervention. Secretary of State Tillerson openly called for some type of military intervention that was also followed by comments from Senator Mark Rubio. So the thinking is that because they see the danger of Maduro winning the presidential vote, that would then ensure that he would remain in power for the next 6 years, that the window of opportunity for an anti-democratic intervention is slowly closing.
Maurice Carney, executive director of Washington, D.C.-based Friends of the Congo, expressed concern about defending Venezuela's Bolivarian Revolution as a model for African peoples attempting to claim sovereignty over their own resources.
If we use the standards of Bolivia, for example, or Venezuela, all we have to do is look to 2002 in Venezuela when there was a coup and Chavez was removed from power. It was the organized masses that came out in the streets and demanded the return of the leader that they elected and put in power. And that organized mass changed the equation to the point where Chavez was put back in power. That type of organized national movement does not exist in the Congo. And understandably so, because Congo has gone through, over the last 50 years, assassinations, dictatorships, wars, invasions, all of them have worked to weaken the institutions in the Congo and those institutions that would form the foundation for such an organized movement, institutions such as labor, women's groups, students' groups, across the board, civil society. So that's one of the biggest challenges facing the Congo in the near and long-term future. That is to develop institutions that are strong enough to protect the interests of the people, such as we see happening in Bolivia, are happening in Venezuela and Ecuador. Those institutions are among the people are strong enough to protect their interests. These are models for Africans to aspire to, because it's a new day in Latin America where the interests of the people are beginning to be served, where the resources of those countries are beginning to be owned by the people. So it would behoove Africans to draw lessons from what's happening in Latin America and apply those lessons.
That was Ajamu Baraka and Maurice Carney on the danger to Venezuela and to Venezuela as a model for African people. In Berkeley, for Pacifica, KPFA and Afrobeat Radio, I'm Ann Garrison.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Dan Raphael, Jasmine Moneymaker, and Sam Bowman. The producer is Kyle Carrezzi. Our engineer is David Kesters. The KBOO Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Zelos Marchand. The podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/evening news. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter at KBOO News. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Aaron J. Bernard.
And I'm Brian Pritchett. Coming up tomorrow morning on KBOO at 7 o'clock, it's Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8, it's Voices from the Edge. At 9 o'clock, it's Press Watch with host Teresa Mitchell, the news you're not supposed to know. At 9:30 on Fight the Empire, we'll run down the latest on Russiagate, plus host Per Fogering recalls his run-in with the late Reverend Billy Graham. At 10 o'clock, it's Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary. At 10:15 on Flashpoints, you'll be joined by host Dennis Bernstein. At 11 o'clock on Between the Covers, David Nyman speaks to Michelle Aronian about her novel, The Brick House, a place where people dream of love and loneliness, of the world's beauty, and of ongoing environmental degradation. And at 11:30 on Black Book Talk, we'll welcome North Portland Library's administrator, Kirby McCurtis, to talk about the latest book awards, including the Coretta Scott King, Newbery, and Caldecott Awards. KBOO's Kickstarter is currently live. Go to kboo.fm/Kickstarter and help KBOO build a city of media makers. That is kboo.fm/Kickstarter.